we're just searching for what we know about cognition, and it seems we have books that talk about it, but we don't know anything.
All I know is that if I talk about it, I piss off cognitive scientists.
Yeah. Yeah, because I have this book. Eva has a book, and I have a book.
Yeah.
Oh, I have books. Yeah.
I have a book about cognition.
Right, right. And we have Brian Hare here in my hometown.
Do you really?
I do.
Wow.
Sorry, that was like a really creepy intro. Hi, Hannah. Hello.
Hi.
That was like a really weird intro going, do you really? Yeah, hello. It's lovely to meet you.
Yeah, because you two don't know each other.
Yeah, we actually have, well, no. I think it's a bit of a one-sided fangirl situation. So we're just going to walk right past that. So yeah, I'm going to try and hold it together. So it's lovely to meet you, Hannah. Hello.
It's nice to meet you too.
Indeed.
So, Eva, this is your topic. What are we talking about today?
Well, I guess this started when I, for some unknown reason this morning, wrote on Facebook that cognition is the most control. And I'm trying to think back what on earth prompted. I mean, I know what prompted the statement, but what prompted putting it on Facebook in some colorful post and tagging John in it?
John McKagan.
Not quite. I'm not quite sure. I think it had to do with some discussions elsewhere. Where we're just seeing discussions where labels, not necessarily cognition, just labels, are used in a way where it sort of hinders the discussion. Is the dog, are you putting up a system of rules, or are you providing information? And then we can discuss, well, I'm trying not to put up strict rules. I'm just trying to provide information, or vice versa. And it's like that type of discussion, you can see it all over, all the time. Mm-hmm. And what it comes down to is stimulus control. And then why I came to think of cognition, I can't really tell you. But it's like whenever we try to discuss anything, it always boils down to us trainers, or us from a behavior analysis perspective, trying to look at, well, what is it that we're really talking about? Mm-hmm. And cognition is such, it's so often that we're talking about something that other people would refer to as cognitive. Mm-hmm. As well, it's about remembering, or it's about perceiving, or it's about understanding. And we as trainers would want to know, what is it that we're talking about? What does it look like?
Is it not also connected to what we once talked about, rule-governed behaviors and stimulus control? Is it not like that mm-hmm. we make this distinction about rule-governed behavior and how much it differs from actually being, you know,
Oops.
Being... Hello?
Oops. Welcome back.
So would you say it's also... kind of like, I'm not saying cognition is related to rule-governed behavior in any way, but I'm saying that often we make this distinction about rule-governed behavior, and we say it's something different than regular.
It's too easy to say it's different instead of investigating what is it really. Mm-hmm. It's too easy to just say, oh, it's different.
Mm-hmm. So what is rule-governed behavior?
Rule-governed behavior, I'm really not the perfect person to explain that, because
don't do rules here.
Hannah, how would you describe rule-governed behavior? Would you? Well, with humans, it's oftentimes it seems as though we're behaving for consequences that we haven't experienced ourselves. You read a sign and it says, put on your helmet or something will hit you over the head and you will die. You haven't really experienced the consequence of being hit over the head and dying, but you can still behave for consequences that you haven't perceived. It doesn't really make sense though, because we will just sort of tease it apart and find what it is that we have learned.
I was gonna say, yeah, I mean, we still learn
to follow that cue somehow, but from my understanding, that's a little bit what
right,
will govern behavior.
Like, we, okay, I don't know anything about what I'm talking about, except for my own voice is messing. I can't do this. I don't know. Sometimes it gets weird. Like, you can describe a contingency, or I can observe a contingency and I can respond to those things without having directly contacted it. But
yeah,
I've already imagined in my head, like I've made a simulation of myself experiencing that.
Possibly.
I mean, I personally do, because that's just how I run, but
yeah, that's still behaving though,
right? Exactly,
that thing you're running it through in your head,
it's still we have the same laws in effect.
Yeah.
So what is cognition?
What are some examples where people would use the term cognition? Would it be when they talk about something like remembering or
understanding?
Memory comes up a lot.
Mm-hmm. Understanding.
I struggle a little bit because I'm often trying to translate, you know, between
mm-hmm.
jargon libraries.
So how's that working? Which way is easier to translate, you think?
For me, it's easier to translate into ABC, actually.
Yeah.
And yeah, to make sense of what contingencies are in place, and then to make sure that we can understand what is the function of the behavior, and what were the antecedents, like, yeah, because.
But even if you have ABCs, I can't see an ABC loop that, you know, that doesn't involve some thought in it. And if you have thought, I'm putting air quotes, you know, is sort of in it, then you must have some kind of cognition, right? There must be learning, there must be memory. You can't.
That's interesting. That's a different. What is the materia that we're talking about?
Is the brain always functioning? I mean, brain is always functioning. So, like, the processes are always there. So, do we need to kind of?
But we have plants that learn, and they don't have a central nervous system.
Yeah, that's true.
But could you have a perception and response in an individual that does not have cognition involved?
Depends on the definition of cognition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is cognition then something physical going on in your brain? If that's the definition, then yeah, no. There will be things going on.
Not a something, but it's not a nothing.
Exactly. Exactly. So it seems to me as if many of those typically cognitive terms mm-hmm. are labels for contingencies.
So where
it's like, and this is interesting, because this is us just discussing this without any of us reading up on any of this at all, which would have been reasonable. Well, I have a book.
Well, you two have books.
We're fully ignorant. We are like cognitive scientists talking about clicker training. It is true.
Fully ignorant. But it's still interesting that if we as trainers behave and talk as if remembering or understanding are different subject matters, different from behavior, then we will get into trouble, I think.
Because it's like separating, I think it's similar to the topic of emotions, like the common approach to emotions. And when you say, oh, this is not a behavior, it's, you shouldn't focus on the behavior, we should, you know, focus on his, her emotions. And like, if this is something different, like if we're talking about, like emotions are not, like this is not behavior. So we are, you know, you should target the, if your animal is lunging and barking and attacking you, you know, he's nervous or he's afraid, and you should target those emotions, not behaviors, because the issue lies in the emotions. And I think this is something
you can get the same
talk about cognition, like, oh, this is not about teaching him some behaviors, it's about teaching him skills to understand something. And
But this, the kind of the argument that the skin isn't a barrier applies, right? So, you know, you can, it's, so the stimulus might still come from outside. Like what Sean was saying, you know, it's sort of, it's discrimination if your stimulus is coming from outside and you're able to classify. So I don't, it makes perfect sense to me to see, you know, stimulus outside, cognition inside, as just one continuum which just goes in and out back, where I would then respond in some way, maybe, or maybe I don't as well, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter where the consequence happens or where the behavior happens, or it's where, still an EBC
or the stimulus. So the stimulus can come from inside your body. I can feel like I have to burp, right? Or I can feel like I have to pee, or I can have a lot of internal sensations. I can feel my pain. I can certainly can feel pain.
Mm-hmm. Or the simulation of death, like what we said, right? So you don't, it's entirely in our head, and yet we have a response to,
we can have
it in a certain way because of it.
Piloerection, like lots of things. Like you can feel, still doing it. You can feel, you can feel like your skin prickles, like, and you can feel your chest get tight. You can feel all of those things, and those are still very much.
It's interesting when we say that we can feel those things. That's an action, right? Feeling.
Mm-hmm. Is perception an action?
Is perception behavior to be dealt with in the same way as other behavior? So that there are antecedents, there are consequences.
There are.
It can be under stimulus control. Yeah,
it's true, because I'm uncomfortable with the word choose here, but we can, under the same conditions, perceive or not perceive specific stimuli. Certainly dogs can, right? You know, or cat, or they're focused on, I'm thinking, you know, my border collie fixating on something I wish he wouldn't fixate on appears to be able to perceive other things like me. Yeah.
And it's like, you know, the training with the cat that Bob Bailey did when they had the cochlear implant in the ear.
Exactly.
And they shaped attending to specific noise and not to human voices and not other noise.
Right. So there is that filtering effect, which appears to respond to training. Therefore, I feel like we can jump that there must be learning, therefore there must be behavior, so there must be contingencies.
Yeah.
Since we can influence it. And we can influence it biologically as well, right? We can influence it with drugs. But that still doesn't exist outside of contingencies.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So one question that I got from Stephanie Edlund in this Facebook post was, like, so what?
I saw that. Yeah.
Which I think is a really good point. It's like, yeah, so what? Agree. It's probably like this, but who cares?
But so what?
Why is it important?
I think it's
for me, so what is that you bridge the world? Sorry, Aga, you first. Yeah. Sorry.
No, go on.
No, go.
See, for me, the so what is that you bridge the world, right? See, because for people who, like us, who have our toes in both worlds in a way, and we're trying to reconcile it, for me to say, actually, there is no barrier between the way my dog thinks and is able to filter out certain things and pay attention to certain things, and that can be reinforced and that can be kind of changed and all these things. You go, well, then I'm bridging, I'm able, it would mean that I would be able to dip into a world that would otherwise be completely inaccessible to me.
Exactly. Yeah. It gives us a way to influence things to change the outcome.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And it's the same with like emotions, cognition. If I want to change how my dog feels about something, I cannot do that like magically, take a magical wand and, you know, change his feelings. I can do that only by the ABCs. And
yes.
I'm going to operationalize those emotions.
Yes. See, exactly.
Yeah. Is there a field of applied cognition? Like, is that a thing? I'm asking a real question here. I don't actually know.
Well, I'm not sure if it's called applied cognition, but there are definitely people like doing applied stuff from a cognitive perspective. Absolutely. Plenty of it.
Okay. I mean,
I guess you would call it cognitive psychology.
Okay. That's fair. That's fair. Yeah. Yeah. Because like for me, I'm thinking in the realm of things that I can influence, my own behavior, you know, those aspects of conditions which I can affect, I often find it helpful to kind of go, you know, work kind of laterally. Let me go up the ladder, like, okay, what is this thing that we're observing? This is described in, you know, the cognitive psychology literature as this. Okay, how do I translate that back into my language, which is going to be more applied behavior, because that's, I am ultimately living the applied behavior lifestyle, right? Because while I do find philosophical discussions fascinating, the reinforcers for me are in, what can I do about it? How can I use this information to change something? So there are things, you know, that I run into with the various range of organisms that I find in my life, that we maybe haven't already described, or we don't have, you know, we haven't explained well yet in our terms. And sometimes it has been explained elsewhere. And so then I can go over there and I can read a little bit about that. And then I can borrow something and, you know, do that reverse translation again. And like, okay. So if I understand, so, you know, I have these physical perceptions, I'm going to call I think that's part of my antecedent picture, right? Like those are effectively cues. And we don't talk about them as much, at least not in the circles that I travel in, but they're real. They're not, and there's more there. It's like you're talking about operationalizing the emotion. I can operationalize frustration as a series of sensations and behaviors that I do. I bite the inside of my mouth a lot. Like I'll have dents. I will have observable dents in my lip at the end of a bad day. I'll have physical sensations, and I can deconstruct that and identify, okay, I need a different outcome. I need to change my conditions. You know, these are all of the elements that I can identify, but just calling it frustration is a little bit of a dead end to me. Okay, I'll just stop being less frustrated. Just stop having anxiety, Hannah. Just stop being so anxious all the time. Chill out. It's not a training plan, guys. Okay, it's not actionable.
And
for
it's
me.
Even more at first, it's dead end and can make you experience those frustration behaviors. Yeah, if you have an aggressive dog, and you should focus on making him more comfortable in this situation and making him, you know, less afraid.
Right.
Great. But how do I do that? And what do I reinforce? What do I change the antecedent behavior?
And we're right back to the what does that look like?
Exactly, because otherwise I just don't have tools. I don't know how to do it. I mean, I'm not working on the brain. I'm not working on the chemicals.
See, it's a more power to you kind of thing, right? If you realize that cognition is behavior, if you realize that emotions are behavior, then you know how to construct a picture to change that, or how to influence that in some way. And that, you know, more power to you. You know, it's a better picture to think of it. I suppose it depends what you want to do. I suppose we come from the point of view where we would like to influence that in a certain way. And therefore this is a very powerful picture to look at.
We are we are Toulouse label control freaks. So
totally.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the thing is, a lot of people from cognitive psychology are as well. It's still you're still really interested in changing behavior. You're just coming to it from a different perspective. I think one issue is that we as a sort of collective society are sometimes behaving as if everybody has all the knowledge about everything and then has picked and chosen the perspective they like the best, and that's why they have the vocabulary that they have or talk in the way they do, or us coming from a behavior analysis perspective and somebody that we're talking with coming from a different perspective. It's not that we made these, oh, I see the full picture, I choose this one. It's so much more just accidental which part
we've been exposed to. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Right. And it's easy to get angry, like, screw you for not knowing everything I know.
You
know,
yeah.
You're deliberately being this way. I'm like,
no, that's not an okay way to live. No.
Yeah.
Damn it.
And then
but if you work go on, sorry.
What becomes the sort of smallest, you call it that in English, the smallest common demeanor, the smallest thing that we have in common, the one thing that
least common denominator.
Least common denominator. Thank you. Is it that least common denominator?
Yes.
Okay. Would be, what does it look like? Under which conditions? What is it that we're looking at?
Operationalize it.
Yeah. And that's what we all do. That's what whoever runs an experiment, they will have operationalized what they're doing. Maybe in the abstract and in the discussion, they use a lot of different labels. But in the method section, there will be an operationalization of what the experiment is. And that will be pretty similar, whether it's a behavior analyst running the experiment
This is fascinating, right? Because I read a lot of papers about cognitive abilities in, you know, dogs and cats and pigs and so on. And the thing that I find fascinating about it is how the experiment is constructed in a way to almost isolate that particular cognitive ability in a way that all the other possible explanations are excluded.
Yeah.
It's fascinating, but I think it also sort of, in some ways, it is fantastic to be able to say, okay, therefore this experiment can only show this ability and not all these other possible abilities.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it also makes those explorations really difficult. Really difficult, because you can't ask very complex questions. So some of the literature in that space, like you live with a dog, right? You kind of go, yeah, if I give him one treat, I give him two treats, and I have a third treat I put behind my back, he knows it's there. You know, it's sort of, we all know that a dog has a concept of quantity, but you kind of, if you want to go out there and prove it, the experiment to do that is really quite complex, to say none of the other things are possibly true. That is the only thing that's true.
Mm.
It's fascinating. I mean, thinking about operationalizing cognition, that's what they're doing, right?
Yeah.
That's actually what they're doing through that experiment.
This goes pretty much back to Agnieszka, our discussion about perfect pitch.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. We are working on it, and I will have data.
On your pitch?
Yay! His pitch. I mean, I'm just a lost cause, so I don't even try.
but it is exactly what you're saying, Vidya, about isolating. What is it that we're talking about when we talk about this perfect pitch? What is it? What is it not?
Because it was like you either have it or not, and the same with cognition. There is a cognition or there is no cognition. So, but there has to be some approximations. I mean, you have to have some of them at least, because otherwise. If you can learn it, and you can learn it, then we need to find some approximations.
Do you know what I was thinking today after you posted this thing, Eva? Was if we were to write out. So I was actually thinking about that, the perfect pitch example, but specifically, let's just take one example of what might be perfect pitch, which would be, you know, you play a note, I say it's an A, right? So that kind of thing. And I was thinking, if you were to kind of sit down and go, here is a flowchart for what happens in that sequence, all the way from for the first time you've never heard it before, all the way to the learnability, all the way to it being applied, you know, if we were to draw that, say, the mind is no barrier, you know, to go through that, what would that look like, right? Because then we would be able to write down the steps. Or would that still be too much of lumping? Would that still be remembering, and we've just written it in this massive cloud, and you know, it's not helpful because there's actually more happening inside. I don't know. I mean, I lack the knowledge for that, but I was genuinely wondering if we could write down that example, maybe it would help us.
Yeah, I'm sure it would, and I'm sure it would help us in both sort of theoretical and practical ways. I think it's both a matter of some kind of Venn diagram of experiments. How do you demonstrate this thing, this ability, this perfect pitch, whatever that is? How do you demonstrate it? Some experiments will demonstrate it. Some experiments you will say, no, that's not it.
Yeah, do you remember there was a guy who was kind of like experimenting, like if this is a perfect pitch or not, but he was not actually doing that because there were we couldn't say that this was a perfect fit because he was always using labels and he was not operationalizing it. So there was no way to kind of like divide it into and say that, yeah, this works as an experiment.
Mm-hmm. So that's like on one level, we have to divide what's inside the concept and what's outside it. And then you have what are the different components of it. And then you have like, how can you learn those different components?
So, Joe sent me this paper, right? Mm-hmm. Joe Lang, he sent me this paper about teaching concepts. And because, you know, I couldn't really talk about much else. And so anyway, and so basically the way that this paper is fascinating, right? It was fascinating. So basically, and now this is how I think about it. So you define any concept as a bunch of must-have attributes and can-have attributes.
Yeah.
And then using that, you can define the examples through which you will exemplify that concept.
Yep.
And then through which you can, so which means that, and this is what I have been thinking about, it means that there must be an optimal minimal number of objects that you can use, which have the must-have attributes and the can-have attributes. So it doesn't have to be inefficient, like how I might teach it, which is I might choose six items, six pairs or something, you know, 5 to 6 pairs or so. But if I were to pay more attention to exactly what objects and how they differ in their must-have, and if I were to tabulate that, right, write down the list, then I could be far more efficient in how I structure my antecedents so that the cognition happens quicker. You know, the click moment where the dog goes from, aha, that's what you want me to do, comes much quicker.
Yeah. Because this is with all your concept teaching, like bigger, smaller, or quantities, or any of those setups. Or just something like teaching a color discrimination. It's going to be, if we want to have color discrimination, it should be color that is the discrimination. It shouldn't also be shape, because then it's like 50-50 whether you are discriminating on color or you're discriminating on shape. And that's something, I guess, that would typically occur in a, there would be something about that in a cognition textbook.
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is how you start
that you would talk about.
Yes, exactly. See, like if you want to start teaching a concept, the first thing I would do is literally go, what are the must-have attributes of this concept? What are the can-have attributes of this concept? How can I create that distinction? And then how do I start weaving in those? So see, this is why I think it makes so much sense to me to think of cognition as just a continuation of behavior, as just another example of behavior, because basically I'm constructing a whole bunch of examples and antecedents. I'm just going through these examples. And at some point that aha moment happens. But it's just a continuation. It's not kind of happening in, you know, it's happening through the examples.
Can you give a specific example of the must-have
Yeah, so. Let me try and remember this properly. So, for example, if I, like exactly what Eva was saying in terms of color discrimination, so you've got a whole bunch of objects. Let's say I want the learner to be able to tell apart yellow from blue, from white, from black. Those are the typical candidates. Everything else about those objects that have that attribute could vary. The only thing that won't vary, the must-have attribute is the color. The shape is a can have, the, you know, you might have the positioning, how close it is, where it is, how close you are to it, how close the learner is to it, all of that doesn't matter. How big it is, how many of them there are, you know, it's all of those things don't matter, where the thing that the must-have is, it has to be of a yellow color. Mm-hmm. And you would teach that by choosing examples that exemplify the color but vary the other things gently over time.
So you'd have a yellow circle, a yellow square, a yellow star, yes. A yellow banana, a yellow lemon, yes. A yellow glove, a yellow hat, yes. A yellow chair.
Yes, yes. I think of it a lot like teaching language. I think if I were to teach somebody who spoke Thai and I wanted to teach them the word yellow, how would I do that? I would point to the sun, I'd go yellow. I would point to a sunflower, I'd go yellow. And I would, it's like attaching a cue. It's exactly, you know, it doesn't help to randomly go yellow, yellow, yellow. You have to kind of specifically say the word that you want associated through specific examples. Mm-hmm. And you're varying everything else around it until at some point you're able to point to a novel item. And that, and the learner at that point is able to apply that rule set and go yellow.
And the behavior, the observable behavior is saying yellow, or the observable behavior is pointing, right?
Oh, the indication, so, yes.
Right,
yes,
that's what I was my yes, next question. Yes. What does that look like? Yeah.
Yeah, so see, this is true as well. So I think it's like, this is quite... I wonder, I mean, okay, these are all completely unformulated chaotic thoughts, right? So this is just me thinking freely, which may or may not be a good thing on a recording. But it's, I see it sort of as very small, maybe tight, like ABC loops, where the indication is its own ABC loop, before which maybe the thought of recognizing yellow happens, I wonder. So you can.
Do you need break... that?
What do you mean?
Do you need the thought when you're training? Do you need to consider whether there is a thought or not?
Well, see, this is what. How would you? For me, it doesn't make sense to go. If I showed you this glorious box of tissues, how do you know what color it is?
I have no
idea. You don't have to say it, right? Like, you don't have to say it. That's different. Like,
yeah.
But I...
So is it a behavior chain, or is it like a compound cue situation? Like, are we responding to both cues at the same time? Or is it a behavior chain or sequence where you are identifying the color and then the action? Like...
I think the actions could be any number of things, right? I could teach... For example, if I were to show a yellow thing, mm-hmm. I could teach my dog to go into a crate. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I show a yellow thing, he goes into a crate. Or I show a yellow thing, he touches another yellow thing.
Mm-hmm. But isn't that, so we have like the thoughts, are they not a part, like the ABC of a thought, is it not a part of every cue? And every behavior and every
exactly my like, first exactly this is what I was saying before in that that's exactly what my question, which is there any behavior where there is not that loop of a thought?
What is the fact thought? That
it's a, so what does the thought look like, or what is the start and end of the thought?
I can run my mouth without thinking all the time. the time.
Fluent.
I don't know. What is the thought?
Like, is there? Is it? Is it what? Like, does it require what we would maybe call consciousness? And I'm going to argue that no, it does not.
And does it include some sort of verbal behavior, some sort of saying things in your head? Because often when we as humans talk about thinking, it's like we say things in,
or we visualize them.
Yeah, mm-hmm. we perceive ourselves doing something.
But do we always do that?
And it makes, that's one of the things that draw me away from my studying psychology ages ago. Mm-hmm. And I didn't go back to university until I had found behavior analysis. Because once we started talking a lot about thinking, then there was such a big gap between if it's my dog doing it or if it's me doing it. If it's my dog doing it, it's behavior under stimulus control. If it's me doing it, it's me thinking and then doing. And it, to me, it makes no sense. If we can do the same thing, we have to sort of...
And we don't need that, actually. I don't need to know if my dog is thinking about something when we train.
Yeah.
In a sense, it's like... I can just observe the behavior, and because I think thinking about talking about thinking, it's always going to be guessing, and it's always going to be an assumption.
I think it depends what the goal of what you're teaching is. So, I think if the behavior on the outside gives you adequate and clear evidence of the thought that you want to create, or the sequence, of the right input goes in, the right output comes out, then you can, it would not be, it's like the emotion, right? So, maybe you can go, okay, that happens as it were.
But how otherwise we can tell? I mean, if you want to have a different proof than observable behavior of a thought or an emotion, how will you do that?
So are you is your question like, how do you have proof that a thought has happened? Is that what you're...
Yes. If you say that, because you said that something if it's enough, and the behavior you see to know that this thought is coming, so you can observe that thought, then that's okay. But do you think that we can actually have a situation where we can have a proof of the thought, not just by observing the behavior? Is there another way?
Beyond measuring brain regions?
Right. We're going to need expensive equipment.
And...
even with the equipment, if we don't have any observable behavior to verify, it's not gonna tell us much.
Yeah, and we don't need it.
But this is where I think it's the stimulus control that we're interested in here. It's like when we talk about the thought, it might be that it's more equivalent of the stimulus control than of the behavior. Because we're not interested with the dog learning to indicate which color something is. Mm. We're not interested in the indication behavior. We're interested in the discrimination.
Yes.
And that's where we might, in our typical language, say that, well, we're interested in how he is thinking. We're interested in how he's perceiving and making the decision. That's about the stimulus control. It's not about the topography of the behavior. It's not about really the function of the behavior either. It's about the stimulus control. That's where we're...
Our training plan. Yeah,
good. Yes. I mean, I keep thinking in terms of indication, there isn't a formal structure around which these concepts are shown and evidenced and things like that, right? So beyond the way... go on.
Right! Right! Like, to me, that's a problem. Like, to me, that's a problem.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
We have to pick something. How do I, like, oh my gosh. So, like, watching bad nose work training, right? And you guys, I know you've watched this, okay? And the person is wandering around. Is this being recorded? This is terrible. This sounds terrible. The dog is wandering around the room. I'm watching these person and dog wandering around the room, and suddenly the person says alert. And I'm like, well, that's like 50-50. I have no idea. Like, I saw no...
I think a great question that I have at that point is, what was the consistent behavior that your dog showed that you are able to... I don't think it has to be understood to everybody else, right?
And
I don't
need to know. It should be able to be described in 500 words or less.
Yes. Yes. There has to be the only purpose of an indication. Yes.
Yes.
For that,
because
dog
it doesn't have to be a nose freeze or
No. Yes. Well, it's exactly
different,
but there should be something.
It has to be under stimulus control.
Otherwise, it's a Ouija board.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I mean, it's.
See, the only purpose of the indication for me is for the dog and the handler to have a very clear communication that I have found the thing. That's it.
We both have to know what it is. We both have to know what it is.
Exactly. And it can be, I don't mind that the indication is even evolved. Like, you know, it doesn't have to be like one behavior, anything. It can be a sequence of things where you notice a change of pace.
You have to be able to tell me what it is for me to have a conversation about it.
And you need to be able to have that conversation outside, where I can go to any dog and handler team and say, how did you know that's what your dog was picking?
Right. Mm-hmm. His tail turns counterclockwise to the right 30 degrees.
Great.
Doesn't matter. But
you need to be able to say that. I were to come to you and I say my indication behavior is a double touch and it's always starting on the right, and you need to see that every time.
Yeah. Because otherwise
we can't say what the dog is perceiving. Like, there has to be an observable, repeatable thing that doesn't require psychic communication.
Yes, this is true. This is true.
Seems pretty obvious, yes.
Psychic communication, I like that.
But some of it does feel like it's psychic communication, though. Like, I watch the video and I really go, how did you know that? I could watch it again and again. And I suppose the benefit in me, the kind of the optimist in me goes, you've probably done this 20,000 times and you just see something I don't about your dog.
That is absolutely a thing. Like, there are things I know that we all, just because of the 10,000 hours, the time that we have put into observing and interacting with our chosen animals in the specific range of behaviors that we focus on, there are things that I can respond to that I may not be able to articulate. In fact, one of my jobs as an instructor is I'm trying to figure out how to articulate something that I am responding to, and I'm going to use the word intuitively as a label. It's not magic. I am perceiving some change in behavior, some stimulus, and I'm coming up with a behavior as a response that has been conditioned in me through learning history. And then part of my job is, great, how can I help you get that? And so what is that, and how does that break down? That's my job as an instructor, and I put a lot of energy into that. And I think it's, I mean, things like, you know, like the examples of, you know, you put a whole bunch of dog trainers in a room watching a video of a dog resource guarding, and we all react way before someone like an average pet owner or a non-dog person, right? Like, we see that split second freeze of the dogs, you know, hovering over the thing. And we know that this is good, that dog's about to guard that thing.
But that's
all of us. It's not magic. No, it's not magic at all. We're responding to a thing. And there's a lot of, there's so many situations like that. It doesn't mean it's easy to articulate. I do think it's our job to do so. And certainly if we're going to publish a paper or a training protocol of how to do this, where I'm making an argument that this is the way to do the thing, we need to be able to articulate that. So,
you know, we have to feel it.
But before before articulating, there is this step. Well, it's a stimulus control thing again. I'm starting to sound like a broken record, I think, but it's a matter of stimulus control and indication behavior on part of the handler or trainer here.
Yep.
So seeing the dog, walking with this one dog, and the dog sees another dog, and you now see something in that dog. Responding to something you see in some way, like in saying, let's turn the other way, or in saying, let's get out of here, or in saying, stop. Or just in you, if you get to watch 10 video clips and you get to sort them, from will there be a reaction from this dog, yes or no. You can sort them. Yes, this, no, not that. Yes, this, no, not that. Mm-hmm. That sorting thing is one thing. That's like one behavior under stimulus control of what you just saw. Articulating what you see is a totally different behavior.
Mm-hmm.
It's like saying that seeing yellow and saying yellow rather than seeing yellow and pointing to something that...
I see we're walking up the trail, I see another dog appear over the horizon, I have a couple of different options. I can say, let's go. I can bring the leash to the center of my body and do a U-turn. I could do a lot of things. I try to limit it to a specific and productive scope, but I have a lot, but those are all different behaviors. And then yet another behavior would be me saying, I see a dog coming over the horizon. Something bad is about to happen. Uh-oh. Like those are all
behaviors.
Very different. Yeah. And they're all different behaviors on the same cue. And then I could pick which one and it would depend on, depends on the contingency, like what's going to be productive. Am I an instructor? I'm narrating for a group class. I'm going to say, I see a dog. I'm going to give the narrative, right? That'll be one behavior. If it's just me hiking alone, there's no point in a narrative. That's wasted time. I need to act, right? I need to get my dog out of that situation before he rehearses a behavior I wish that he would not rehearse.
Yeah. And oftentimes we can probably do a more fine discrimination in our response of saying, yes, go ahead, or no, turn around.
Yes.
Compared to what we can do if we are listing what we're looking at, because we don't have access to all of those things. We can't say, I cannot say all the things that are in the picture that my behavior is under stimulus control.
Yeah. My dog has removed 3 degrees of tension from the leash, or there are so many things that I'm probably responding.
And they are in compound and combination and in a certain sequence and in relation to the environment. It's so complex. Mm-hmm. So our behavior of going, uh-oh, stop, it's under stimulus control of all those things together. But us saying something about it, it's just that we can say a few things.
Yeah. And it's decoupled. See, okay, this is like a completely random confession. I hope there is some point to it when I finish saying this. But so recently I've been teaching myself, you know how sometimes when you're sitting as a passenger in a car and, you know, the person who's driving the car is backing the car out and you see something that they haven't seen?
Yeah.
Right? And at this point, my natural thing is to go, stop. I kind of have this natural response to that's how I communicate the thought that, you know, the registering of the obstacle or whatever it is. And I have been trying for months now to not just communicate a panic response, but to communicate the action that the person must do.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yep. And it is proving very, very difficult for me. So I want to be able to decouple the observation of the obstacle. Great, tick, I've done that. I've understood, I've had this moment of cognition when I've thought this is something we need to respond to in this car. Maybe this person hasn't seen it. But instead of just going, what I want to be able to say is, stop the car or punch it or, you know, get out of the way or whatever it might be. And these are all the possible, just like what you're saying, Hannah, you know, these are all the possible avenues of expression for that process. And it's really difficult to prioritize one over the other.
Mm-hmm. Which there's a stimulus control and discriminative stimulus modifier cue.
Yeah.
Like, how do I pick which of those to do?
How do I pick which of those? And no matter, maybe this is just me and I'm just the slow learner I am, but maybe it's the number of times I rehearse this and mm-hmm. post hoc, I go, next time I'm not going to scream.
What are you going to do instead? And how much do you need to practice if you're going to do 1,000 different things instead of just the same one? Because if you go, you can... Right. You can do that under a wide variety of conditions.
Yeah,
but if you can differentiate, you both need to learn all those new responses and get them rehearsed so that they can conquer
those
one.
Exactly, exactly. It makes perfect sense to me, therefore, to almost pause the, to go, seen the stimulus, made sense of it, assessed that it's a threat, you know, whatever happens in my head, and then indication behavior, you know, it's like my, you can kind of go, there are so many indications possible, and I want to rehearse one, you know, so that I'm being helpful, not just panicky. But it makes sense to me, therefore, to make that change.
What would it sound like if you did it all out loud? All the things that you just said that you can do in your head?
Like when she is in the car with someone.
Uh-huh. So you said observe.
Yeah. So there's a perception component. I'm looking.
What can you say out loud?
I would say a car is pulling out of another spot.
Okay, car.
Say,
and then
okay.
It would be like the assessment part.
Yeah, so the assessment part is that I extrapolate that if we were to continue on our trajectory,
collision path.
Yeah, exactly. But see, that is an imagination as well, right? It hasn't happened. I've not been in that car crash, but I'm able to go, if we were to continue like this. So what's that? How am I able to?
Is it not experience somehow? Is it not learning that you have seen those accidents happen and you have seen movies and you have seen tons of different situations? And sometimes, like when, for example, you know that if you like roller coasters, I was recently on a roller coaster, and it's like you are on the roller coaster and it goes very fast down and up and on the sides. And usually if my experience with going very fast down would be from the movies and all the things would be that we're gonna have a crash, right? Because this is what happens. But then even if it's the first time, you know that in this condition, true, gonna happen differently. But if I probably had this crash, I would maybe had a different experience. But I would say it's always experience, and even if it's not a direct experience,
true,
it's still an experience and still learning. So it's not just imagination, because imagination for me is also like a history of history of learning. This is imagination.
You've seen other things collide when their trajectories carry each other forward, right? Yeah. Like,
I'm not going to try and think of all the viral YouTube videos I've seen.
Shopping carts, poorly driven.
Exactly.
Yeah,
see, but then the interest. Yeah. Is it interesting at that point that we are all able to say that if the what if scenario, isn't that interesting to be able to have that what if calculation?
And it is when we do that, when we talk about it, our talking is still just us behaving. It's like we can't really behave. We can't behave for the future. We have to behave
for now.
Yeah. Yes. And based on the past.
It's always based on the past.
It's always based on the past. We can't do.
Even if it's for example
on future.
Yeah, even if it's not your experience. I mean, even if you don't have, if I'm doing something for the very first time in my life, how will I behave? It's based on my past experience with different things. It's like with teaching a behavior, like working on healing, right? And you are working only in healing. You don't work on any other thing. And then you slowly start to do something else in your training. So you do position changes and your healing changes because it was influenced by something completely different, some other experience that is, or your position changes were, even if this is the first time you do them, they were kind of influenced by healing because there are some common ground there. So there is always past history, and even with the totally new things.
But then do we not go back into the question of how we remember the past history? You know, going back to that chapter in Eva's book.
What is it that we're doing when we remember?
Yes, from one repetition to the next.
What happened what happened to begin with? It's like what happened when we got in contact with it the first time.
So it's, is it not the brain? I mean, it's a history of reinforcement and punishments, but the remembering, isn't it like the brain is functioning all the time and this is just a process that is happening? And
so when a cognitive scientist would talk about, or a cognitive psychologist would talk about, do you call it encoding, like the time when you perceive something, that one thing, that one time that you, when you come across similar stimuli or stimuli that occasion similar behavior later, you will say, oh, I just remember this. The thing that's happening when you come across it the first time seems to be somehow significant. Sometimes you meet somebody and they tell you their name, and 2 weeks later you meet the same person. Seeing that person occasions you thinking or saying the name. Then you met some other person 5 minutes later. They also said their name. But 2 weeks later when you meet them, or 2 minutes later when you meet them, seeing them doesn't occasion you thinking or saying their name. So there are differences both in when you heard the name the first time and when you saw them that second time.
But you could perhaps describe them still as differences in the contingencies.
Yeah. Yeah, most likely, yeah. They have to be. How else?
Where the second contingency, like if I were to meet somebody 10 minutes later and I can't remember their name, has to do with the first...
No, it's a lousy example, because when would you ever?
Yeah, it's like they say their name, but I noticed that my attention, I am, other stimuli are more important. Like their dog is, what is the name of the dog, what leash they have, what, those are more important things. So, because I have to really pay attention to when they say their name to remember it, and it's still very hard.
So you are responding to when you hear it the first time. There has to be some responding for you to be able to.
There has to be, yeah. Something in the environment that there are no other more interesting, other stimuli that I have a greater reinforcement.
Is it about salient cues? Is it about which cues, cues? Totally. Have more prominence than others.
Right, based on your learning history. And then we're back to perception as a behavior, because we selectively respond to stimuli in our environment, because we would melt into a puddle if we were tried to respond to all the stimuli in our environment at all time.
Yes.
Yeah, we can't.
See, the other interesting thing I was thinking about whenever you were writing about cognition and stimulus control is that my set of my set of kind of conditions that trigger a certain, say, thought process or whatever, whatever conclusion, is very different to yours. And it's sort of, that's what, going back to, well, we think everybody has the same information. It's it's interesting to think of how different, like what makes me think of a pink elephant is different to what makes you think of a pink elephant.
Yeah. It's so much in the learning history.
So can we summarize the topic? Because I think we should do that.
Please do. I'm so
excited. Go on, Aga. Go on.
I know, I just made a point that we should.
Summarized, none of us know anything about cognition.
Yes, exactly.
We've read Eva just enough to be dangerous.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Eva and
to
I
feel like we ought to get together and talk about it.
So, yeah. That's a perfect summary. But yeah, I think we can summarize. But I think that we can summarize it saying that we need to just simply describe what we see and operationalize it if we want to use it effectively, especially if we are training and teaching new behaviors, because otherwise it's not going to be useful if we just give it a label. And cognition can be, if we don't describe it, what we really mean when we say cognition, it's just going to be another label.
And that we can, it is actually possible to make sense of what people that are using a different different language, in a sense, are talking about.
Yeah.
It's not magic. It's not from some other world. It's from the same world. It's based on the same observations. Yeah. It's just different ways of talking about it.
And probably it will be the same, operationalized in the same way if we had to just describe it.
Right. I think the category is pretty arbitrary. We have more in common than we have different, really.
Totally. So
probably fighting is silly.
In general, I think that quote.
That's just a true statement. True.
Yeah, I know. Well, no, some of the time it's worth it. Resist.
But yeah, and that we can, it's super helpful to go back to our basics of observation and down to the ABCs.
I think many, many issues people have among themselves would be resolved very quickly if we were just describing things we see and not giving them labels.
Yeah.
And it doesn't
to think, what is the purpose? Like, what is the purpose of this?
Take the lid off the box. What's
inside? And it's not a matter of saying, I'm only going to talk about this if I get to do it in my ABC way. It's not about that. It's about, can we find what is it that we're talking about? Mm-hmm. Just let's figure out the topic that we're discussing.
Yeah.
And
because we may argue about
what's the term again? Common denominator.
Lowest common denominator.
Lowest common denominator.
That word.
Denominator. That word. Lowest common denominator. Let's find that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That was great. Okay.
So we solved it.
Yeah, we solved it. So it was easy.
That was easy.
Yes, baby. What do you need?
I'm coming.
I've sent all of you a paper. It's chapter about match to sample on my book about cognition.
So, thank you.
Wonderful. Looking forward.
Wonderful. Well, looking forward to reading trained, that.
So that's a good thing to look at.
Yeah. So
yeah, everyone. They can either do it or they can't do it. You can't learn it. You can't teach it.
Sorry. No. And you have to feel it.
You have to feel it.
Yeah.
It comes from the inside, people.
From the heart.
Like you have to have a sixth sense. So if you don't, I'm really sorry. Okay, thank you.
We were ending on a good note, but not anymore. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Okay.
Perfect.
No, all right. Thank you, guys. That was really fun. Cheers.
Okay, bye.
See ya.
What are you doing?